Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the Walter Paisley Building in beautiful Midtown Portsmouth, it's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Rob Floyd, and co-host, Phyllis Floyd. Tonight's topic, Death Race 2000. Well, good evening, everybody.
Hiya.
Welcome back to the old podcast here. Looks like we're hopefully back on schedule after the busy October there, and we really don't have any events coming up to to push tonight, so no real announcements. We got the regular Phantasmo Cult Cinema Explosion coming the first Friday in December. That's about it, and that is the double feature of Batman Returns and The Watchmen. Superhero Night, costume contest, all kinds of cool stuff. Prizes, door prizes to give out. Check out the Phantasmo Cult Cinema Explosion Facebook page for more info on that. And so we'll just dive right into the topic tonight.
Yes, let's. Death Race 2000.
One of my favorite all-time Roger Corman movies.
Yeah, we're not talking about the new one.
No. Screw that. That piece of crap. this is the classic campy satire Roger Corman film from 1975. David Carradine.
Sylvester Stallone.
Stallone. It's like, God, I don't know, third or fourth movie, but it's like it's really second movie of note.
Right.
I think he did Lords of Flatbush right before this, and then he did this with Corman. And
apparently while he was filming this, in the interviews that we watched, it said that he was writing a boxing movie.
Living in someone's closet in an apartment writing this boxing movie.
Yes.
So this was actually a year before he did Rocky. And he's good. You know, he's funny. He plays a gangster driver, Machine Gun Joe Viterbo. That's his last name.
Viterbo. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Which I guess we should explain a little bit about what the plot of this movie before we get into all the
briefly
intricacies about it,
because there's a lot.
Well, yeah, it is a satire. Dark.
It's not. Say it ain't so.
Hey, ooh, close that window. Somebody let a smart ass in.
No satire here.
No, dark comedy satire of it takes place and taking place in the far flung future of the year 2000. Of America.
Say that again real fast.
No, I'm not even going to try. Satire of America's obsession with sports and violence and combination of it's kind of a racing take on the soup over the top characters like in wrestling and things like that. All sports have been outlawed except for the transcontinental road race, the death race. And the way you score and win in this, if you haven't seen this, which if you haven't, by God, go out and watch it right now.
please.
This racers, they have these gimmicks and they have names and costumes, and we'll get into that in a minute. But they race across country and they score points by hit and run. And the points, babies and old people are the most points. Was it teenagers or next? Did you write the points?
I wrote it down so that
cool.
I wouldn't forget.
Right on.
Women are 10 points. Teens are 40 points. Toddlers under 12 are 70 points. Over 75 is 100 points. And later we learned that race officials are 50 points.
Yeah, so if you score race official, well, you know, which is very hard to do. That's pretty much the plot. It is overseen, or everything has been abolished except the death race, by Mr. President, who is the monarch, pretty much, of the United States. And actually, I don't know if they even say United States. They
no,
just say America.
I don't think they do.
The flag is very different in this. It's the American flag, but instead of red, white, and blue, it's red and gold. And where the stars are is a familiar-looking fist with a upside-down lightning bolt in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the flag of America. And the race is overseen by the deacon of the church, who's dressed in the Pope outfit with the big Pope hat, with two gold fists on the side of his robes. I guess he gives the holy blessing to the race. The characters in the race are, let's see, it's Matilda the Hun, Calamity Jane, Nero the Hero, played by Martin Cove, the bad sensei from Karate Kid, and the goober sheriff from Last House on the Left, we talked about in another episode.
Right.
And, yeah, Machine Gun Joe Viterbo, Stallone, and David Carradine as Frankenstein. The favorite, though, I think the most winner, or the all-time winner of the death race.
The most winner. That was good.
Yeah, well, you know, I was trying to drink and talk at the same time. Mix myself up another salad here.
He was the, I guess, the all-time favorite. He had won.
He's won the most races.
He had won the most, yeah. Well, and they say right off the bat that Frankenstein, yeah, he's aptly named because he's been in so many accidents and had so many appendages.
Yeah, more rebuilt parts than a man anymore. And he has this cool black S&M leather-looking outfit with zippers and stuff and this face mask that it's almost like a luchador. You only see the eyes and around the mouth. And he has a cape. Because you got to have a cape.
You know? Well, and I just learned that apparently it wasn't a leather outfit because David Carradine, and I should have thought of this because I do know this about David Carradine, wouldn't wear leather.
Yeah, he's a hippie from way back. And yeah, he would refuse to wear leather, so they had to find some material that shined and looked kind of like leather to make his outfit out of. And the cars, oh man, the cars they drive are cool. They're souped up, gimmicky looking, you know, Batmobile-like cars. Yeah.
Well, each car has its very own theme.
Just like the driver.
That goes along with the driver. So, you know, Machine Gun Joe, his car looks like a gangster car, kind of. It's all black.
It's got machine guns where the headlights are and a big Bowie knife on the front of it that he uses to great effect in a couple places in the film.
Indeed. Then there's the
Calamity Jane.
Calamity Jane
has
car.
Big bullhorns.
Yeah,
on
it's
the front.
Like a cowboy car.
And Nero the Hero. God, what is his car? I can't even remember. His car is just.
I don't know what that theme was. I probably
it was supposed
should,
to be like
but,
Roman Gladiator, but it really didn't look
like
a chariot.
Like that, no.
What's it? Matilda the Hun's kind of like a German tank, supposed to be But Frankenstein's car, the monster, the green monster with the teeth on the front and the red headlights for eyes. And the big spikes going up the back. I want that car.
It is pretty awesome.
I would drive that car. I would drive that car so hard. But anyway.
You might have a problem, dear.
I'm sorry. Oh, interesting thing about the cars, though. They were all. Now, I find conflicting accounts of this, looking some stuff up. And some of the text you'll find says they were built off of different chassis. Like Frankenstein's car was built off a Corvette. Nero's car was built off of Fiat Spider, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, but that goes against what Corman
said. But Roger
said.
Corman himself said, and we know Roger Corman doesn't like to spend a lot of money, so all the cars were actually built off Volkswagens.
Right. He said he bought used Volkswagens, and then they
took the bodies
took the
off
bodies
the chassis.
Off.
And Dean Jeffries, who built the Black Beauty, the Green Hornet Black Beauty car, and the Monkey Mobile from the Monkey Show, built the fiberglass bodies that went over the chassis. And he saved a lot of money doing it that way.
And there was only one. They didn't have any stunt cars.
Of each car. So when they wrecked one, they had to make it count. And Corman, though, this is neat. This is a funny little tidbit. Carradine and Stallone did most of the driving that they could. They wanted to do more, but they did most of their driving. And what they couldn't do, of course, the stunt drivers would do, you know. But the stunt drivers wouldn't drive at one particular time when they were driving through the city streets that they had closed off because the cars weren't street legal. So Roger Corman himself actually drove the different cars when they were driving through the city, at least according to Roger Corman, that is. And other stuff with the cars, Mary Woronov never drove her car at all. She was played Calamity Jane.
Because she couldn't drive.
No, she lived in New York all her life up until that point. This was her first real film other than the Warhol stuff she did. So she never learned to drive up to now. So when it's her stunt driver the whole time, except when you see close-ups of her, like just making faces and turning the wheel, or it looks like she's driving, the car's being pulled on a trailer. And the camera's right in front of her. Of course, they did the usual tricks to make the cars like they're going faster, undercranking the camera so it, you know, films at a different speed and looks like the cars are going a lot faster and stuff like that. But, man, taking a chance with just having one of each car, that's like unheard of today, even on low-budget, you know, films.
I mean, anything could have happened. They'd be screwed.
Oh, yeah.
Quite
yeah.
interesting.
You know, another thing, too, about this film, that if it was done today, you know what we'd have?
A bloodbath?
Action figures.
Oh.
I mean, this movie is
and
screaming.
Cars.
Yeah, and like Matchbox cars or cars for the action. This movie is screaming for action figures.
That would be awesome.
Well, because, you know, everybody in it is such a flamboyant, like, character and in your face, and the cars are so distinctive.
Maybe you need to make some.
Well, there have been. People have done customs, I've seen. And, yeah, I will get around to it at some point. Hey, well, you know, let's talk about who's in the movie, though. We glossed over that. We got David Carradine.
Yes.
Marty Cove.
Sylvester Stallone.
Mary Warrenoff. Fred Grandy. Gopher from Love Boat. A very small role. Has a couple lines, but he's Matilda the Hun's navigator.
Yes.
And, the real Don Steele. Don Steele was a pretty well-known DJ in California back in the 70s. I want to say 60s and 70s, maybe. And he was the real Don Steele. And he was the guy that talked like this all the time, like a DJ, like the cliche DJ does. And that was his shtick, his gimmick. And, you know, he was around for a good long while. And he is over the top in this.
He's the TV announcer.
Oh, yeah. And then and the actress that plays the other TV announcer, Grace Pander, great name for this character. Because she's always going, and Frankenstein, a close personal friend of mine.
Yes,
everybody she talks about
person she talks
is
to
a
is a close
dear
person
friend,
or friend
of hers.
Yes.
Sounds like somebody we've known before. Anyway. and Paul Bartel. Who actually was the director of this. And if you're a fan of, you know, cult weird movies, which why would you be listening to this if you weren't?
Indeed.
you should know Paul Bartel. He directed this. He directed Eating Raoul, which is a, you know, super cult classic with Mary Warrenoff. And, God, a great many other films. He's been in a few films, too. You know, he was in Eating Raoul. And he has a small part in this playing the doctor that brings Frankenstein into the country. But he was perfect for directing this. And actually, I think it was, had, he and Corman butted heads a little bit in the, I think it had a lot more funny comedy type stuff in it. But Corman kind of nixed that. I don't know if he nixed it in the editing or nixed it in the, during filming or whatever.
Yeah, I didn't get an answer to that either. But I know that he wanted it to be funny, but he wanted it to have some serious satire.
When he originally wrote the story, what was the story? It was taken from a book called The Race, or a short story called The Racer.
Yes.
God, who wrote that?
I didn't get a name. I was listening for the author's name, but I never heard it.
I'm sure they said it on the commentary. But anyway, it was a short story called The Racer, and the story itself was not a comedy. It was bloody and gory and super serious. And Corman's first draft of this was more like that, but after he wrote it, he really, you know, realized, well, he wanted to inject some satire in it, and so he changed it up a little bit.
Right.
And boy, did he.
Yeah, you ain't kidding.
Some of the stuff in it, besides you've got these cliche TV announcers. You got Junior, who is, wasn't that great, and The Race is great, and that guy, and then Grace Pander, the close personal friend of mine. And then the other guy, who's like a cross between Howard Cosell and Harry Reasoner. You know? And he's so serious the entire time. And always has a little anecdote. The Race was first developed back in the, you know, some history that relates to, really has no bearing on what they're talking about. But he always has to put that little anecdote in there. And they're all great, over-the-top cliche characters.
Right.
And it all just, it fits. This could have been a really silly movie. And some people might think it is, you know, who don't like this kind of stuff. But it comes off as a fun action, you know, dark, more of an action than a dark comedy. But if you're not watching it, I mean, when I was younger and watched it, I didn't see all the as much of the satire and the dark humor as when you're older, so you can enjoy it on a couple different levels.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not paying a lot of attention, you could probably kind of miss. I'm even not paying attention, you probably wouldn't miss some of the really obvious satire. But.
Well, you've got, you know, from the get go, they lay out what The Race is right at the very beginning, and give you a little bit of the history.
It's what America wants.
Yes, what America wants. The race is the only standard of excellence left, is what they call it. And
well, that's what Frankenstein says.
Yeah, yeah. And but they lay that out and they let you know, you know, there's no other sports, there's no other games,
mm-hmm.
and how the country is run. Without saying it, you see these things come out. They go to a live telecast or simulcast at the beginning of the race to Mr. President, who's at his summer palace in Peking.
Right.
So you're
the president is running the country from his summer palace in Peking.
Yeah. So how far does, you know, in this far flung future of the year 2000, you know, does America's reach, you know, cover mm-hmm. what, you know, in this, and what other, you know, was monarch or was it? Would it be totalitarian?
Yeah.
I guess, you know, how else is America like that? You don't really see much of that. Well, they didn't have the budget to show you.
Well, I mean, and the only thing we know about anyone outside of America is that apparently we're at war with the French.
Or at least the government tells the public.
Yes.
That the French are to blame
for everything.
For the economy and the failure of our phone system. And they say that a couple times, those two things, you know. But also you get right close to the beginning, you see the resistance who wants to stop the race. And that's all they ever say, I believe that's all they ever say. But you get the feeling they're the resistance. They want to overthrow the current administration.
Right.
And it's led by this old lady, Thomasina Paine, descendant of Thomas Paine. Look it up, kids. It's history. And you find out her connection to the race a little later on in the film. But the resistance is trying throughout the film to stop Frankenstein and replace him with a double. And then...
Because I guess they assume that Frankenstein's going to win because he's won the
most. Oh, yeah, because he wins. And Frankenstein, you find out Frankenstein is the government's sweetheart, basically. He's their man. He's the symbol of the race. And he's been rebuilt by the government every time he wrecks to race again.
Yes, but was he really rebuilt?
Well, we'll get into that in a second. But they want to capture Frankenstein and hold him hostage.
Right.
To get Mr. President to abolish the race. What they don't know is that there's not just one Frankenstein. There's one Frankenstein at a time.
Yes, Frankenstein is like a clone or a test tube baby or
What I got out of it is later on, Carradine's character says...
Well, didn't he say he was grown in a lab?
No, no, he was raised.
Raised?
For one reason.
I swear I thought he said something about
something,
that.
Or an orphan.
Yeah, maybe.
Raised. And so you get the impression that they raise these kids or raise, you know, get these people and groom them to be Frankenstein. So when one dies in a wreck... They bring another in and say that, and that's why they can look different and sound different too, because, you know, oh, his arm got blown off, his legs got blown off, we had to rebuild his spleen, you know, or whatever. And so he comes back a little different each time.
Well, and I got that they were different people, but for some reason I really thought that they were like growing the same one. But okay, I'm with you.
Well, it looks like we'll have to watch it again.
I guess so. Well, I mean, in either way, it's fine because he's got a mask on. So even if it was a different person,
so he's got this mask
tell.
That covers his face. And you see the skin under the face looks like it's all cracked
and
burned and stuff.
Up, yeah.
But that's part of the mask, too. Because when he pulls the mask off, it's like, hey, it's David Carradine.
He's got the, you know, perfect skin
hey,
or
it's
whatever.
Kane with hair. one thing, though, I didn't get or wondered about is in the film at one point, well, before, let me backtrack a little bit. Frankenstein's navigator, you find out, is Thomasina Paine's
great-granddaughter,
and she's become his navigator to stop Frankenstein somehow.
Well, and to help the resistance in their attempt to kidnap him.
Yeah, and if
whatever.
They can't, then she's supposed to stop him.
Right.
Frankenstein kind of falls for her, and he reveals that his hand, you see, he goes to bed with her a couple times. They stop. They have three stops across country to rest during the race.
Right.
And each time, of course, the navigator and their driver, you know, sleep together, have sex, or they do it.
Because apparently the navigator works very hard to get to that position, and that's her reward.
Yeah.
In order to sleep with the
or
driver.
Or his, depending
or his
on the driver.
Driver, yeah, that's right. At least that's what one of Frankenstein's groupies tells us.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a minute. That's a pretty cool
that's
scene.
That's a whole other thing.
But Frankenstein, he never takes the glove off. I guess it was
his right hand.
He never takes the glove off. Takes the whole suit off, not the glove. So at one point later in the film, she says, why don't you ever take your glove off? And he takes it off, and he's got like a steel hand with a grenade in the palm. And he says, it's a hand grenade. And, it's such a cheesy throwaway line. But Carradine delivers it so matter-of-factly and moves on to the next line. You don't have time to go, wah, wah. You're sitting there going, did he just say hand grenade?
Yes. Yeah, it was pretty funny.
So, and he tells her, but you see, this is the part that gets me, because you never, I don't think he says why, but he says his goal in life is to win this. And so this is the first time this Frankenstein has raced.
Right.
Because
the last one got into a big accident,
yeah.
Right?
And he says his goal is to meet Mr. President, because the winner gets to shake hands with Mr. President at the end of the race. And his goal is to meet Mr. President, and when they shake hands, the grenade goes off and blows them both up.
Right.
Or at least blows up, Mr. President, mainly. But you never find out why he's doing it. And, is he working with somebody else? Is it his own idea? Because the resistance is trying to stop Mr. President, too.
Right.
But they don't know that they think Frankenstein is the corporate tool that he's supposed to be. And apparently the government, has no clue either, because there's that one scene where they've stopped overnight and the government lackeys come in and say, Frankenstein, we need to talk to you. And they take him outside and they're like, did you change course? Was that your idea? You're a navigator, and he's protecting the navigator. He's like,
right, so he says it's my idea.
And he's acts a little flustered, like, I don't know why so-and-so went the other way or why they blew up or blah, blah, blah. And he's talking to the government like they're drilling him, just making sure he's still doing like he's supposed to.
On their side.
Yeah. So that kind of throws you a little bit. I want to know the backstory, though. I want to know why he decided to kill Mr. President or stop it.
Yeah.
Was it his idea, or is he, because at the end of the film, you don't know.
You don't. And, it's one of those things where
he going to spoil
curious.
It for you. He does end up killing Mr. President a different way. In the end of the film after that, he and his navigator married, and he is now President Frankenstein. And of course, he abolishes the race and everything's nice and happy and all that stuff. But you don't know where he comes from. And for years, I didn't even think about it. It didn't bother me. I didn't care. And now it's killing me.
Well, it's funny because it's one of those things where, sometimes you and I will talk about movies and we'll say, well, I don't know why they had to tell us all this backstory information. The audience isn't stupid. We can certainly deduct things for ourselves. But this is one of those things where we come into the middle of a story, kind of.
Yeah.
And we don't know what his motivation for, he didn't strike me as power hungry and think he was going to become the next president.
No,
so I don't think that's it.
He doesn't give, I don't need to know his entire backstory.
No, but it'd be nice to know. Was he treated badly in the camps or whatever where they raised him?
He doesn't give a reason.
Right.
I don't need the whole backstory. The resistance gives a reason.
Right.
They tell about, the violence and getting back to values and all this. But Frankenstein is just, this is my goal to do this. Why? Well, we don't know. He never says.
Well, and at one point, his navigator says, well, I don't want you to die to kill Mr. President, or however she words it. And he says that he was raised his whole life for this. This was his mission. So maybe he was just somebody infiltrated wherever he was raised and just instilled that in him. I don't know.
Yeah, could have been. But like I said,
we will never know.
And you don't need to know it doesn't take away from the movie at all. I mean, I still watch a movie over and over and over and over again and enjoy the hell out of it. Now, let's go back to that scene you were talking about, though.
With Frankenstein's groupie or whatever.
Yeah, there's one scene where they're stopped overnight and Frankenstein's walking away from all the crowd. They're getting massages and being interviewed on TV. And he walks away and he notices somebody's following him. So he ducks around the corner, and this young girl in a short skirt and a black shirt with a big white F on it for Frankenstein.
Yes.
Comes out and he asks her who she is. And she's, what is it, the president of the whatever local chapter, the Lovers of Frankenstein, basic fan club. And, oh man, it's like a cultist.
She is
starry-eyed, and how that they, only they understand what he feels, and she just wanted him to know who she was tomorrow. And
let him know how much they loved him and
how much he
appreciated
means to him.
What he's done, and all these things. Yeah, she goes on and on. And he said, well, are you here to offer me your body? And she said, oh, no, I wouldn't take that away from your navigator. She worked so hard to get that position. That's her reward. And he said, well, if you're not here to offer me your body, then why are you here? And she goes on to say more wonderful things about him.
I want you to know who I was so it'll mean something tomorrow.
Right.
And you come to find out tomorrow, she's standing out on the interstate in a white, like a sacrificial virgin dress.
With her arms spread out wide.
Waiting to be run over. And he does, because that's what her life means, is to have that happen.
Right.
So even though Frankenstein's the good guy, it's like, He had to do it. If he didn't, she would probably kill herself anyway, I guess.
Right.
An interesting little thing there is that that girl was actually the director, Paul Bartel's sister. So nepotism is alive and well, even in low-budget films. you know, this film, I found this out. I don't know if we talked about this the other night. But it was shot in only 17 days.
Yes, I heard them say that.
17 days they shot this film, and the budget was $300,000.
Wow.
That's all they had to make. That barely covers catering. I bet
that's why they only had one car each.
Yeah, I bet your craft services on the Avengers was more than $300,000.
Probably.
And it made $5 million at the box office. Now, that's nothing to today's standards.
But it was a lot then. I mean, they said it was a very well-received film.
Yeah, if you think $300,000 was the cost and the return was $5 million,
right,
for a low-budget, you know, movie that played mainly drive-ins and, you know, in some hard-top houses, mm-hmm. Not too shabby. Not too shabby. A lot of the other, you'll see, watch the movie, you'll see this, you know, the satire, the government controlling the media, and basically when one of the first time when Nero the Hero was the first one to get killed.
Right.
And when he gets blown up by the resistance. Right.
Oh,
in the
it
middle,
wasn't the resistance.
No. It was the
At least
French.
That's what the government tells us.
No, right in the middle of a broadcast where Junior is saying that he got blown up, a government guy walks onto the camera and hands him a note and he says, no, he's fine, he's okay.
Yeah.
Or he ran into a tree. That was the official story.
He ran into a tree, but he's all right.
Yeah. So they cover up, I mean, everything throughout the race must go on, and it must be perfect and you know, be everything it's supposed to be. It can't be, have one.
And, you know, I don't know that they ever, later they do have, like, the official broadcast saying that he's been killed in some kind of accident or something. I can't remember. Did they blame the French for that? I can't remember.
I think so. And I think it's after Matilda the Hun. They pull a Wile E. Coyote on her. It's beautiful.
Oh, God. It really is. I was watching like a Looney Tunes.
Well, they drive
Studios.
Through all these tunnels on these mountain roads. And what they do for her is they set up right outside of the tunnel.
A detour.
They set up a detour sign. And what they've done is on the edge of the cliff, they have erected a facade, a brick. Well, it's a cardboard, but it looks like painted like brick facade and another tunnel with like a black sheet. And she drives through the black sheet off the cliff.
Yes.
It's great.
To her death. I was just waiting for the little poof thing, like from Wile E. Coyote.
But no, it blew up.
It blew up.
It blew up. It blew up good.
It blew up good.
Real good. Man, what are the others? The satire. My favorite part, my favorite thing in the movie is the exclamation. And Junior says it a lot. He says, Jesus Chrysler! Which is amazing. I'm gonna start saying that in everyday
Jesus
life.
Jesus Chrysler.
Yeah.
Oh no.
And you know, if you're not paying attention, it goes right by you. But
but he says it so much, it's got to be obvious.
Yeah. And they say that they started the death race after the world crash of 79.
Yes.
Not the stock market crash, the world crash.
And not the world war, but
no.
The world crash.
And I want to know what was the world
what
crash.
What exactly is a world crash?
Because I remember 79 a little bit. Now that, of course, we had the gas shortage and all that, but hey, you know. There's some conflicting info in when you look stuff up and then you hear like Corman talk on the commentary. One thing I read was says Peter Fonda was their first choice for Frankenstein, but Corman says out of his mouth on the extras on the DVD, he says that Carradine was always his first choice. And Carradine had said in an interview that when he took the role, this was right after he finished doing Kung Fu.
Right.
Kung Fu, I think, had just ended the, I don't know, second, third season, however many it went on.
Yeah.
And he was like, I guess to not get typecast in the Shaolin monk peaceful character, he went right into doing this Frankenstein, which is a total opposite of that character.
Yes, and I think I remember Corman saying that it was that his salary was actually one of the largest hits to the budget.
Oh, yeah, well, because he was the man.
Well, no, I know, but yeah, I mean, right, at of everything time, else that they had to buy, Carradine's salary was the biggest hunk.
Oh, yeah, well, and he was one of the biggest stars, right, well, that that's Corman what I was had worked saying. With.
Yeah, he had gotten a big name at this point. Yeah. So
now, I mean, you know, Corman has worked, everybody has worked with Corman.
Right.
Has come through, is pretty much used Corman as school, mm-hmm. as film school.
Right.
I mean, Ron Howard went through there. He went through and he acted in some Corman films and he directed a picture for Corman. I think Eat My Dust, I think it was. I could be wrong on that. And I remember a quote from seeing Ron Howard in an interview that he said he didn't want to direct the movie. He didn't feel like, you know, I don't know if I want to do it. I don't know if I can. And Roger Corman told him, he said, Ronnie, direct this movie for me and you'll never have to work for me again. And he was right. And his directing career took off after that, you know. But I mean, God, the people that came through Corman, you're talking about heavyweights like Jack Nicholson,
mm-hmm.
started out in Corman films. Joe Dante worked as like second unit director for Corman. Did Kubrick? I don't know if Kubrick. Who else did they say?
I'm spacing on all the names now. I just remember being flabbergasted because there were so many.
Yeah, De Niro, I think, worked for
yes.
for Corman. I want to say, I don't know if John Milius did. God, I should have read
the
all
list
this down.
Goes on.
There's a long list of people that worked for Corman, and I tell you, you know, look him up because it's fascinating. All the people. And all the movies that Corman did. I mean, he's known these days as, low-budget schlock stuff. And, yeah, that's pretty much what he's turned out in the last few years. But you look at some of his early stuff. I mean, it was low-budget, but it was pretty quality stuff. All that Corman, all the Poe stuff he did with Vincent Price,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's low-budget. But, man, those are pretty good films.
Yep.
And quality for the money. I mean, you got beautiful sets. You got good actors in it. In addition to Vincent Price. And those were, you know, good, solid films. Once he gets past the 60s into the 70s, then you start getting into more of the you know, campy genre stuff like Death Race and then Cannonball and Death Sport, which was kind of a sequel to Death Race, but not really. And then he goes on from there. But we're talking about Death Race 2000. A couple other things about this. This first scene at the beginning, I thought this was kind of cool. There's this, well, if you look at them like Blu-ray or high-def DVD, you can really tell the matte painting
with the big
behind the crowd scene at the racetrack. But that first scene with there's a marching band and the racers racing around stuff was filmed at an actual racetrack in between races
right.
one day. So they had to get in there, get those shots, and get out. One thing I love about 70s sci-fi and future movies and genre is you can tell that they were filmed in the 70s because, you know, a lot of the hairstyles don't really change. they still have 70s hairstyles for the most part. And some of the, and I love 60, well, anything, 50, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s future tech.
Yeah.
I love that stuff. It is so funny and so cool to see what back then they thought future stuff was going to look like and be like, where we've passed stuff like that, you know, God, by leaps and bounds. I mean, hell, we've pretty much almost bypassed stuff that was in Star Trek, Next Generation?
Some of the things.
Which a lot of that was touchscreen stuff and all. We're you know, past that. I mean,
it's pretty amazing.
But Death Race 2000. Oh, and the opening credits. This is a low budget. The opening credits are hand drawn graphics.
Yes,
and it's
well,
cool.
There's a huge crowd in the stadium because they went to an actual.
I'm talking about before that. I'm talking about the opening credits.
Oh, the credits. I'm sorry.
When the car is on.
Yeah,
drawn
the credits
image.
Are really cool looking,
and it's charming.
Yeah,
you know, it
I like
really
it a lot.
Is. And it changes, and the hub, you see in the hubcap, there's drawn like a body going. It's really cool. But yeah, what you were saying there,
Well, you had started on the crowd scene.
Yeah.
And they've got this futuristic matte painting off to the right-hand side. But the crowd itself is they went to a racetrack.
Yeah,
and
so
they filmed most this of the giant crowd.
And but then as the crowd goes further away from you, it becomes a matte painting.
Right.
And but they do have some movement. There's some futuristic buildings behind them in the painting, and also in this tube. And in that tube,
it's
there's
like a little train or
yeah,
something.
Like a monorail car goes by. Yeah. And Corman was saying, and he's right, is that little bit of movement with that car going by draws your eye to that and takes it away from the matte painting itself. So you don't really notice it as much.
So, well, let me tell you, on the new technology that we have with the DVDs and Blu-ray and beautiful giant television screens, there is no way to not know that that's a matte painting. But you know what?
But
it's all the more charming for it because looks awesome.
Yeah, but you know, he's right, though. It does draw your eye away from it for enough time that then it's gone.
Yeah.
So you're not dwelling on how cheesy the painting looks.
No, you're dwelling on how cheesy the monorail looked. But that's okay. It was still awesome.
one thing I forgot to mention, another thing that's kind of cool or funny, is the first kill in the movie. I think it's that construction worker or something in the middle of the road.
Yeah, that's right.
Machine gun Joe gets up. The first kill, a little after that, Grace Pandra goes and interviews his widow, the first kill's widow. And because he was the first kill, she wins all these prizes.
Yes, she was yay for her.
A
you
new
just
home,
lost your husband,
and, yeah.
But you get all this stuff.
A big 3D TV and all this money and a trip and all this stuff. And it's like, well, so she loses, but she wins. So it's still cool.
And she looks so, she's crying, but she looks so happy. It was bizarre.
Now, here's something I just found out today looking up some things.
Oh, do tell.
A few years ago, they did an 8-issue comic book series of Death Race 2020.
Really?
With Frankenstein. And it looks like the Carradine Frankenstein character.
Well, that's
I saw the covers of it. I am going down to my local comic shop this week and see if they can locate that series for me. It was under Corman's short-lived Cosmic Comics label.
Yes. So, Wayne, if you're listening, tell Rob that you have it, hopefully.
Wayne will find it.
Yes, Wayne will find
it. He's a good man by finding stuff. Another thing, if you love this movie like I do, if you have not seen another Corman film called Hollywood Boulevard, this is his send-up, and I think Paul Bartel might have directed that, too. It's his send-up of the Hollywood scene. Mm-hmm. At the time, and the story of this girl comes from the Midwest somewhere and goes to Hollywood to make her dream come true about getting into pictures, and it's in the 70s, and I believe it was shot with a lot of stock footage and leftover film from other Corman pictures. One thing that's, you get some stock footage from Death Race, but the reason you do is because Mary Warnoff's in this one too. It's been such a long time since I've seen it. It was on Netflix for a while. I don't know if it still is. But there's a scene where, and they're filming different movies, or there's a lot of different scenes in this one movie they're filming. But there's one where they get in these cars and they're in these costumes and they're chasing after each other. And there's some of the cars from Death Race. And Mary Warnoff is in the Frankenstein outfit driving the monster car.
Really?
Yeah. I really need to see this again to see why they were doing that. But I remember watching it just one afternoon. I was like, oh, cool. I've heard about this. I never saw it. I'm watching it. Da, 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 da. Whoa.
What?
That's in the Death Race cars. and of course, this was just filmed not long after that. So this stuff was still lying around, you know.
Right.
I do believe the Frankenstein car, the actual car, is in a movie car museum. I want to say it's in Illinois somewhere. I don't know if any of the other cars are still around or if they survived.
Well, at least one of them fell off a cliff.
Well, yeah, Matilda the Huns and Nero the Heroes got blown up. And Calamity Jane's blew up.
Yeah, hers blew up too.
So, yeah, so they blew them all up. Even Joe Viterbo. He's got blown up at the end.
It sure did.
Yeah, so Frankenstein's was the only one to survive, far as we know, anyway.
Yeah.
I don't think they blew up models. I think they blew up the real cars.
Well,
I have to check into that.
Yeah, we
should
look.
Hey,
I'm
if you're
positive.
In Illinois, stop by the movie car museum.
Road trip. Let's go to Illinois.
Oh, man, I'd love to see that car. It's awesome. It is so over-the-top cheesy. But you know what? It still looks better than Nolan's Batmobile. And you can take that to the bank. Yeah, Dean Jeffries, man. You know, it built those cars. And, of course, the Black Beauty, which is one of my favorite all-time TV superhero cars from the Green Hornet. I'd love to have that too. But did a bang up job on these, man. They're so cheesy and so over the top. It's great.
They are. I mean, they look like little cartoon cars. I mean,
you know, they lend themselves. They should have been. It, you know, this was before the big action figure or merchandising boom, I should say.
Yeah, but they would make awesome
Matchbox
cars.
The Batman series, when that came out in the 60s, had a lot of merchandising. And surprisingly, Green Hornet was only on for one season, and I'm still seeing merchandise now that came out for that. Mm-hmm. I never have seen before knew existed. And I was trying to collect that stuff for a while, you
right.
know.
Yeah, I know.
Back a while back with Jesse and Clayton and all. And I still will. If you ain't Green Hornet toys you don't want, send them my way. But I'm talking about the original 66 series, not that piece of crap movie that came out a few years ago that I will not even acknowledge exists.
What are you talking about? What movie?
I don't know. But the merchandising wasn't big like it is now. I mean, Batman was a craze. That was a super fad. And, you know, there's a lot of merchandise. And Green Hornet, they were trying to cash in on that, so they made a lot of stuff for that. But other than that, they really didn't put out a lot of merchandise. I mean, there was a bit of stuff for the Munsters and a bit of stuff for the Addams Family. But other than that, there wasn't for other movies or TV shows quite like that until right. Planet of the Apes. Planet of the Apes, the movies were pretty popular, but when the TV show hit, they started to put out a lot more merchandise than they ever did before. And that was just before Star Wars. Star Wars gets a lot of credit for creating this huge merchandise monster that it is now, which, granted, it did. But just before that, Planet of the Apes really kind of started the ball rolling or started the ramp up. And Lucas took off with it with Star Wars. And
well, if you thought Lucas took off with it. You should see what Disney has done.
Yeah, well, I'm not talking about... Well, yeah, Star Wars, yeah. But and just I'm talking about in general for this type of stuff. But Death Race 2000... I mean, well, think about other movies that came out around in the early 70s. Logan's Run.
Right. It had a TV show. Where's all the stuff?
Yeah, but it didn't have... I don't know. It didn't catch on. It didn't have the popularity. But, man, they could have done action figures. They could have done vehicles. They could have done, you know, the toy guns and all that kind of stuff. Robots and things right. like that. But they didn't. Death Race 2000 has these over-the-top characters. Each individual costumes that could have had cars and play sets and all that stuff.
Oh, can you imagine the play sets? That would have been awesome.
Yeah, and they just didn't capitalize. Of course, they couldn't capitalize on it. They had no money. It was a low-budget movie. It wasn't a studio movie.
Violence, 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 Rob.
Because
America loves it.
Well, you know, they did then. Well, they do now, too. I mean, you know, we're just a year or two away from Running Man, right?
Yeah.
That's supposed to happen soon. But yeah, once Star Wars hit, boom, that was it. And then every movie after Star Wars tried to cash in on that merchandise. And they're still doing it today, you mm-hmm. know. So, and there's that. I would love to have a set of Death Race figures, though. But, yeah, check out Hollywood Boulevard if you've seen or haven't seen Death Race 2000. Once you watch it, try to find Hollywood Boulevard and check that out. I think that's the only other. I did hear that the new the Death Race remake movie with Statham there, which I just can't bring myself to watch, does have a voiceover at the beginning by Carradine as Frankenstein. And I almost want to see it. Just to see that part, to see
well,
if
he's
like
YouTube, just the beginning.
I tried.
Oh, you didn't.
It's not on there.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not on there.
Darn.
Maybe it'll be on Netflix, and I'll just watch that one part. I wonder if he's just like passing the torch or what have you.
I don't know.
Well, to the next Frankenstein.
I've seen maybe 30 minutes of that movie, and it wasn't the very beginning, but it was in the beginning. So I tried to watch it.
Yeah.
I just couldn't get very far. I mean, as an action movie, it probably was quite fun because there was a whole lot of action going on. But I didn't see that it had anything to do with Death Race 2000. I don't even know why they call it Death Race 2000.
Well, they don't. It's just called Death Race.
Well, that's true.
What
You're
threw
right.
me off?
Death...
What threw
so
me off?
The 2000s, whatever. But still, Death Race, why? I mean,
I don't
from
know.
What I gathered, they were racing.
Well, I think, I could be wrong, but I think it's they have prisoners, inmates
right, right.
race, and the winner gets to live.
Free.
The others die.
Yeah.
So they're racing to not die.
Not
so not death race.
Yes.
What threw me is, in besides the fact that I just hate remakes and can't stand them, watching the trailers and all, the color palette was so drab. And, you know, just grays and browns and dark colors and boring as shit.
But, Rob, it's so realistic and gritty.
I'm making the jerk-off motion with my hand here. It's boring as hell. You know, I go to the movies. I want to be entertained. I want spectacle. You know, I see real life every day, and it's fucking scary. Okay, you know? I don't want to see real life in my escapism entertainment. You know, I want to see over-the-top entertainment. I want a feast for my eyes, and gray and brown and black and dull, boring, you know, monotone sepia-like colors and all. It's just a drag, man.
Doesn't do it. Although,
it's a drag. It's overdone, too. That's one thing. It's overdone these days. It's like not even cool because it's done to damn death.
Well, it is what it is. But can I just point out that I find it quite funny that you said you want all these bright colors and whatnot in your escapism entertainment, when Death Race 2000 is really not just escapism entertainment. I mean, there's so much in this movie. Look at all the satire and the statement that it makes.
Yeah, there's the political, social satire and all that, and that's cool. But the thing about it is, like this, in this and in, you know, the original, The Planet of the Apes,
yeah,
it's there. It's not spoon-fed or thrown in your face.
Right, right.
But it's there. Well, that's what makes it great. The whole time. And you can watch it on one level and just enjoy it for what it is, you know, visually what it is, or you can watch it on another level and read into all that and absorb all that and go, wow, you know, man. And Star Trek was always that way. The original Star Trek.
Right.
Was built on social commentary and allegories to modern day problems and things, you know, but people don't see that a lot of times. They just see the, you know, dun 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 dun. That was the Kirk banging chick music.
And green.
No,
chicks.
I'm sorry, that was the fight music. But but this is the same way on a lighter, much lighter level or scale, but it's still so much fun. And if you haven't seen it, I believe it is still in print and very easy to find. Death Race 2000. In fact, I think it came out on Blu-ray recently.
Well, we should get that.
Yeah, we just have the DVD copy, and it's a good transfer.
Oh, yeah, very.
Good transfer, but I bet the Blu-ray is amazing looking.
I'm sure.
So go out, get it, rent it, buy it, and watch it now.
You will not regret it.
You will not. I think that's about all I've got on this. I could just gush over it.
Yes. Well, though, you did not mention that John Landis had a little scene.
Yeah, John Landis, man, shows up in the 70s. He showed up, little cameos and tons of, he was in Battle for the Planet of the Apes. He had a little small scene, you know, in the background, one of the humans. And he has a small, you know, cameo in this as one of the mechanics on one of the cars. If you blink, you're going to miss him. And he just seems like a really neat guy, showing up in stuff like that all over the place. And man, you talk about, you know, fantastic directors, directed some great damn films. Maybe we'll do a John Landis podcast at some point.
Oh, we should. That'd be good.
So I believe that's it. Do you have anything else?
I think that was it. I just remember you mentioning that you wanted to say something about
John Landis.
No,
I'm glad you pointed that out, because I've always liked John Landis.
I cannot think of anything else. I'm sure there is something wonderful, but you will discover it on your own when you watch the
movie.
That's
right. You watch the film. Tell us anything we missed. Hey, you know what? You know how you can do that? You can drop us a line at phantasmode@gmail.com. That is phantasmode@gmail.com. Or on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page, drop us a line. Tell us what, you know, tell us anything we missed in the movie or we forgot to talk about. Or, you know, tell us how much you like the movie or tell us, you know, you like the podcast or tell us that you don't like the podcast and to go to hell and never do another one. Just let us know you're there.
You're sounding a little desperate there.
I'm not desperate, not at all. But, you know, it's Phantasmo After Dark on Facebook and the Phantasmo AD gmail.com email.
Yes.
Drop us a line, won't you?
Yes. And you know, you're listening to the podcast already, but in case you need a different venue or a different avenue listen to it, you can find us on iTunes, and you can also find us on Stitcher.
And Podbean.
Yes, Podbean is where we are hosted.
Yeah. And as we said in the last episode, future episodes here, we are going to have some guest hosts. I promise we'll get around to it. It's been so busy lately with stuff.
Well, we've had some technical issues on how to get that to happen, but we're working
on it.
Via
satellite, a couple of old friends of mine are individually I'm going to get together with here over the airwaves with Joe and with Clayton, and we're going to talk about some really cool stuff. And some other folks hopefully will drop by the lounge here in some future episodes, and we'll mix it up a bit.
Indeed.
So until then, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Good night.
Good night.